Paper 38, section 3, which is old single column, page 420. Okay, so let's remind ourselves where we are. We have a pair of papers we're doing here on the angels. So this first one is entitled The Ministering Spirits of the Local Universe. And so it's the more general one. They're not just dealing with the seraphim, but the immediately associated beings as well that we'll get to at the end of the paper. Well, we started, you're working, on the seraphim a little bit, the general aspects of the seraphim. So having done those first two sections, having covered what they wanted us to have just up front, they throw in this little aside section, section 3. You see, this is a single paragraph section, vaguely titled Unrevealed Angels. So let's just read it, and we'll see why they're doing it, especially when we get into the subsequent section a little bit more. But they're trying to give us, as best an idea as they can, always, of the nature of these beings. There's invariably, issues of, and there's invariably issues of, revelatory mandate boundaries that they're up against. You can tell. And so, you always want to be, really looking closely for any little hints of, what might be on the other side of the veil that they're not allowed to draw back. You can see that right away when we get into this. If you're aware of the basic patterns that you start to notice as you're studying the Revelation, even though they don't say anything directly, your gears should start turning, and you're thinking, "Oh, I wonder if I know what's going on here with these unrevealed angels." Okay, so let's just read it and see what we have here.
3 unrevealed angels. Numerous orders of spirit beings function throughout the domains of the local universe that are unrevealed to mortals because they are in no manner connected with the evolutionary plan of paradise ascension. In this paper, the word angel is purposely limited to the designation of those seraphic and associated offspring of the universe mother spirit who are so largely concerned with the operation of the plans of mortal survival. There serve in the local universe 6 other orders of related beings, the unrevealed angels, who are not in any specific manner connected with those universe activities pertaining to the paradise ascent of evolutionary mortals. These 6 groups of angelic associates are never called seraphim, neither are they referred to as ministering spirits. These personalities are wholly occupied with the administrative and other affairs of Nebadon, engagements which are in no way related to man's progressive career of spiritual ascent and perfection attainment.
Okay, now, if your eyes didn't glaze over a little bit, you should have noticed something there. Okay, there's just a handful of sentences there, and in every single sentence, they emphasized and re-emphasized a certain fact. In the first one, they're unrevealed to mortals because they are in no manner connected with the evolutionary plan of paradise ascension. You go to this second sentence, and it says, that they're not largely concerned with the operation of the plans of mortal survival. Go to the next one. You know, it says, who are not in any specific manner connected with those universe activities pertaining to the paradise ascent of evolutionary mortals. You go to the next one. You know, and it says, they're referred to as the ministering spirits. And the last one, are in no way related to man's progressive career in spiritual ascent and perfection attainment. Okay, so that seems perhaps a little overkill. Okay, every single sentence in the one paragraph section, basically saying the same thing. Okay, hint, 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 you know, they're saying. Okay, you're wanting your gears to turn a little bit and go, oh, 6 + 1 = 7, right? So you have seraphim, an order of this type of being that's directly related to the seventh of the seven schemes, basic schemes in the universe of universes. Right? You have seven super universes. You have seven schemes. One of each of those schemes is dominant in each of, you know, in a particular super universe. All seven are in each of the seven. One is dominant in each. This is the seventh super universe. The ascension scheme is dominant in the seventh super universe. It seems pretty obvious, especially if you just notice how they kept saying, okay, the ascension scheme, the ascension scheme, the ascension scheme, the ascension scheme that needs ministers, and saying that over and over again. You know, it should be pretty suspicious that what we're talking about for the other six is those other six schemes, those other skips, six major schemes of activity in the universe of universes. all right, so that's... that's just screaming at you. You know, they're using this opportunity to talk about something they can't talk about. To emphasize, you know, getting you to think, you know, in this pattern recognition mode. They're wanting you to start to put these pieces together, and because they're not allowed to spoon feed the whole picture to you. Divine revelation is at best half the story. Okay, the other half you have to complete yourself. The human philosophy half, your reflective thinking, fleshing out a logical picture, that's up to you. They're not allowed to do that part to you. And occasionally, like here, you can see them very, much stressing, please, okay, think. Don't just sit here and mindlessly, listen to these words, because sacred texts should be reverenced, okay? It's not a sacred text. It's a magnificent text, but it's a philosophic text. And it's only half of the sphere. You have to construct the other half. And it starts with simple little things like that. And builds from there. All right, so, if you think about that, that's basically all that's going on there, see? It's an excuse to have that many sentences repeat over and over again, getting you thinking about those seven schemes. And then you can just, you can appreciate that these aren't just sort of, other things that happen. They're just as, these other six are just as major as the ascension scheme. There's six other things that's just as important to the universe as you and your ascension. Okay, which for us initially we think, well, that's the whole universe just is all about me and my ascension. No, yeah. It's not. Okay, right. So just really stressing that. Yeah.
Well, I thought for sure we were going to read about those angels that are unrevealed between us and the midwayers.
But you're not. I see.
Where are they? Where would I find them in the book? Because I've been looking and looking.
And, again, go to the Seraphington, Secrets of Seraphington section.
Okay.
You know, and that's where they primarily mention. Yes, so go back to the Father's worlds. Right, that's not here. You know, remember we stressed that up front, that, you know, they're definitely not talking about that, you know, even hinting at that other one. You know, they said things up front like, so the seraphim with the associated cherubim and sanabim constitute the angelic core of a local universe, period. Well, not quite, right? I mean, you gotta, you know, you can't read that sentence out of context with of that reminder that there's a whole other order of angels that they're not allowed to talk about, you know. So it's a quote-unquote period. You know, you have to be, right, see, there's half the picture always that's not being talked about, and it might be something as simple as that. See, again, you know, that they were allowed to mention it a couple times, well, technically three times, but that's it. And then you have to fill in the blank the rest of the time. And it's a huge blank. I mean, it's something that's very, very intimately related to us and is nowhere even being talked about here in this paper we're in.
I guess they revealed that they gave it a whole section through in capital letters.
Okay. In this so what's the difference between unrevealed and undisclosed?
I know, I'm just saying the importance of it must have been very important to give it that place.
It's important to, for, you know, they're trying to make sure that you construct a complete picture beyond what they can say directly. And, you know, those other six orders of quote-unquote angels, those other six type of seraphim-like beings, they're not undisclosed. I mean, right, there's a whole section devoted to disclosing their existence, but they are unrevealed. You know, and what's the difference? They've given you a couple fact points, and you can fill in some more fact points like we just did, you know, that they're tied to the other six schemes, self-evidently. But what's the truth of their existence? You know, you disclose facts, you reveal truth. Okay? So none of the words that you read in here are the revelation of truth. Every word in the Urantia book is a disclosure of fact only. It's up to you to recognize the truth that's there, which can't be put in words. Okay? And sometimes, the truth is going to be so remote that it's really going to be inaccessible by and large. I mean, they weren't allowed to reveal. So they weren't allowed to put facts, words in the book where you can really find the truth that flows through those facts relative to certain things. Those truths are off limits. Some of the facts are not, and are either said or you'll deduce them as you start to put the pieces together. You know, things like the creative mother agencies of the Ancients of Days. I mean, again, they're quote-unquote unrevealed. They're not undisclosed. And so those issues, you know, and, you know, here we're confronted with, you have some coordinated essential knowledge, some facts that you need to have so that you're not inappropriately biasing your picture. You know, like I was stressing, you know, the biggie here is that it's all of the universe is all about you and your ascension scheme. Okay, they know that the more they reveal this sort of stuff, the more tendency there is for you to form a you-centered universe and have everything revolving around you. You know. Finaliters are the most important thing in the universe of universes because I'm going to be one. You know, those sorts of thoughts are just natural for, you know, the kind of humans that want to know who's going to sit at the right hand of Jesus. Right? So, you know, they're trying to mitigate against that as best they can. But it's still bottom line up to you to not produce such a you-centric universe out of the revelation. Okay, so so beyond that details, you know, it's also just another little reminder. We're talking about the various types of beings that are the offspring, you know, at the top of it all, of the infinite spirit, you know, and there's infinitely more, you know, effectively infinitely more unrevealed than there is revealed. You know, there's an uncountable number. They're not even disclosed, even remotely disclosed, you know, and we don't want. So that's also between the lines there. Just again, a reminder that, I mean, even when you're on the mansion worlds, you're going to start to have a much bigger, more complex universe disclosed to you. If not literally, you know, you'll confront it. You know, on your, from the first mansion world, you'll walk up. It's like, wait a minute, this being was not in the Urantia book. What are you? Right? There's going to be endless beings like that, you know, that aren't in here, even on the first mansion world. So you know, if you're, as long as you're comfortable with mystery, it should be exciting, because it's, you know, all kinds of fun things await you that you can't even speculate about right now. All right, I don't think there's anything else I need to say up front. Other than it was kind of funny. In this paper, the word "quote unquote" angel is purposely limited to the designation of those seraphic and associated offspring of the universe mother spirit, okay, you know, who are associated with the ascension scheme. But of course, the title of it is Unrevealed Angels. So there's a little asterisk, you know, except that we had no other word to use, and we had to break our rule and use it there. But all right, go ahead.
Four, the seraphic worlds. The ninth group of seven primary spheres in the Salvington circuit are the worlds of the seraphim. Each of these worlds has six tributary satellites, whereon are the special schools devoted to all phases of seraphic training. While the seraphim have access to all 49 worlds comprising this group of Salvington spheres, they exclusively occupy only the first cluster of seven. The remaining six clusters are occupied by the six orders of angelic associates unrevealed on Urantia. Each such group maintains headquarters on one of these six primary worlds and carries on specialized activities on the six tributary satellites. Each angelic order has free access to all the worlds of these seven diverse groups.
Okay, so the next paragraph seals the deal. Okay, because, you know, it was highly suspicious that we were talking about the other six major schemes in that previous paragraph. Here, what do you have? They literally tell you that these seven different types of beings each have one of the seven primary satellites with its sub-satellites dedicated to them. Okay, so that's sevenfold. Right, we know right up front that when you're going around the 70 worlds, 70 primary worlds around Salvington, 70 primary satellites, and they're broken up into 10 groups of seven, that seven is the sevenfoldness, like the seven super universes, like the seven master spirits. It's not like the seven circuits of Avona. It's not that seven. It's the seven master spirit-like seven, the seven major schemes seven. Yeah, so that, you know, seals it right there. That sevenfold individuation of spirit unity is what's involved in these seven different types of angelic-like beings. And each of them has their own flavor of a Havona-like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. The six sub-satellites in the primary world, like we've pointed out, that's one particular way that you can count 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 through the seven circuits of Avona. There's going to be one of the Avona worlds on the first circuit that's tied to, you know, one of those, one of the worlds on the second Avona circuit that's tied to the second one, et cetera. you know, all those different combinations of seven, where you pick one in the first, one in the second circuit, one in the third circuit, you know, and count 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Huh? You know, all these endless sevens, different kinds of sevens, are those. You know, but there's one very universal seven. The 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, like the seven worlds of the Father, Seraphington being one of them. You know, that seven is these seven different types of beings. Did you have something there? Okay. So between the two of them, you can definitively come to a conclusion about that, because you've followed all their clues, and you know that the seven, in a set of seven worlds is the one that it is, okay, and not the other one. All right, now. What else do you have in there? Let's remind ourselves again. This is the ninth group here. We've just about made our way all the way around Salvington. So we had, let's see if we can, remember them. We've got the first group of seven was the Melchizedek worlds, and then the Verondadek worlds, and then the Lenonendek worlds. Okay, so those are kind of easy to remember. You just go down those three. Okay, and then about as easy to remember. Then you have the life carrier worlds. Okay, and then it gets a little tricky. Number five, but if you remember, five is half of 10, so it's midway. That's the finality group. So you throw in that kind of different one. Okay, and then it goes into a different mode, where instead of having the suns that you were going through, then you had the brilliant evening stars. Okay. Can someone tell me what the next one was? You remember when we were reading that paper and they're high beings? They talked about them right after the brilliant evening stars. The what? No. I mean, it's got to be a local universe. Right? That's a high spirit being.
An archangel,
the archangel's worlds, right? Okay. And then, okay, this is the ninth one. What the eighth one was? Spirit-fused mortals. Okay, and then now we're up to the seraphim. Well, and the related, seraphim-like beings. Okay, so we're working our way around, we're gonna be reading about angels here for a while, and then we're hoping to get past this. It's like, well, I'm looking for the 10th group. I just kind of keep that in mind. Remember, we're at this point, in following through the worlds, you're kind of expectant of that final one. So we'll be looking for that as we go forward. All right, let's see. What else do we have in there? You notice how they made a point of emphasizing that each angelic order has free access to all worlds. It seems like, again, it's a little bit, repeatedly stressed there, and you're kind of curious about that. That whole bit about those seven, major schemes. You start to thinking about them, and you recognize their association with the seven super universes, and you could start to think that, so all that goes on in the seven super universes is the ascension scheme, right? But no. Okay, the other six schemes are here, and they're freely, the seven schemes are all intermingling. And you can see them intermingling right there. See? They're trying to stress the equality and the overlap of those schemes. Right? Okay, so that's what's between the lines there, why they seem to be, because let's see, where was that other spot where they... Well, relationship, of course, but I'm just, you know, I'm just kind of thinking, wanting you to think initially literally, you know, that you don't take the seventh super universe and it's like, okay, well, this part of it is for that scheme and this part of it, you know, they're overlaid on each other. I mean, another way that you see that very literally is you have this seven reflective spirits in each super universe, right? But you have one, you know, presence of the reflective mother spirits, of the reflective mother spirits. So, you know, despite the sevenfoldness, it's one. You know, and so they're together as one. They're not, you know, separated, you know, into their own, you know, sectors or whatever you want to say. Okay. All right. So you have. So obviously, you know, the moment you're on the mansion worlds, you could expect, see, that you're going to be in a domain where the other six schemes are intermingled with what's, you know, what you're immediately up to, like trying to ascend. Yeah, like I said, so see, there's, you know, as soon as you open your eyes, you're going to be confronted with a whole bunch of stuff that's not even remotely suggested in here. All right, let's see. Let's get some more here.
These headquarters worlds are among the magnificent realms of Nebanon. The seraphic estates are characterized by both beauty and vastness. Here, each seraphim has a real home, and home means the domicile of two seraphim. They live in pairs.
Yeah, it's a curious, tiny little paragraph. But you know, they want you to just have that little vignette. The thing that strikes you, they're among the magnificent realms of Nebadon. You know, remember how when we were reading about the Melchizedek worlds, we saw them commenting about how, you know, you're going to be in awe of the Melchizedek worlds in a way that's really not even going to be trumped by paradise. You know, see, and they, you know, we haven't heard them say things like that really, you know, as we've been going around the world, but here we see it again. So that's kind of intriguing that they're saying that this, I mean, it's all beautiful, obviously, but there's going to be something about the beauty here that will be sort of a very immediately compelling to us. And they go, okay, so maybe that's because, you know, like they were pointing out as we were reading last time, the closeness between angels and humans. You know, so maybe that's why it's so immediate. And the fact that a Melchizedek can, you know, can even make themselves a material being in terms of their manifestation, hence their have a closeness. So, you know, you're starting to spec now that maybe that's kind of what's going on with those statements, that maybe it's has a little bit of relativity to us. I mean, I suppose it's universally beautiful, but you know, but maybe it's exceedingly exceptional for us, just because of what we are, compared to some other being. You go, well, yeah, it's really beautiful, but you know, for me, I mean, nothing trumps, you know, the seventh group of worlds or whatever, you know. All right, you know, we're about to get a little bit more on this, but that whole bit about the pairs, you know, so they set up a quote-unquote home and they live in their positive-negative pairs. Let's see. Now, I suppose the other thing that's maybe kind of curious there is, here each seraphim has a real home. That seems kind of curious, a little stressing there.
Easy for us to relate to.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I'm not totally sure what to make of that, but, you know, it might again be stressing kind of along the lines that Don was just saying there. You know, maybe the domiciles of other beings are a little less of an extrapolation of what we can imagine right now, you know, and maybe this, in our wildest imagination, maybe, you know, we're getting a little bit closer to this.
They live in pairs.
Right.
So, states,
Yeah, so that maybe is what's behind that.
My thought was that they're on assignment so much that maybe that they have a real home back home. Who knows where they're living here when they're out here on assignment.
These don't sound like rentals.
Well, no, I mean, that's what she's saying. But that's what she's saying. That right, I mean, that these are, you know, because they're so often living in rentals, because they're out on assignment all the time, okay, they have a real home, and, you know, and yes, I agree, that's, you know, just about to mention that, that's also seems to be something that's between the lines, that you might wonder, you know, with, are they just nomads in the universe of universes, because we're always reading about the angels are being sent here and there and everywhere, you know, do they ever just get to sit back and put their feet up? You know, so you know, that seems to be there too. Right, so there's also that issue of it seems logical for them to have a quote-unquote home because they're functioning for such a long span of time, not as ascending or descending beings, but more stationary-like beings, more horizontal beings. And so you can kind of just reflect on the various shades of that. All right.
Though not male and female, as are the material suns and the mortal races, seraphim are negative and positive. In the majority of assignments, it requires two angels to accomplish the task. When they are not encircuited, they can work alone. Neither do they require complements of being when stationary. Ordinarily, they retain their original complements of being, but not necessarily. Such associations are primarily necessitated by function. They are not characterized by sex emotion, though they are exceedingly personal and truly affectionate.
Okay. Aspect they were stressing at the end, you know, we were sort of reminding us, we stressed that some last time in what we in the first part read in the first part of this paper, that they don't have any of the sensuous emotions, because they're definitively not sex creatures. And you notice a fun little thing they did there. Okay, so they said, you know, like they normally do, male and female. And you're kind of expecting them to say positive and negative, but look, they flipped it. They purposely did negative and positive. Because they don't want you to just think that that's synonyms. You know, positive and negative are synonyms for male and female. They purposely flipped them. Now, it is the case, you know, that when you call positive aggressive, and you call negative retiring. Now we all recognize, you know, the parallel to male being an expression of direction and female being an expression of place. But here, by flipping it, they're actually trying to encourage you to get it in the proper order to make sure you appreciate that place and direction are transcendent twofoldness of male and female. That you can take that very, very high transcendent fact of direction, place, twofoldness, and you can downstep it as male, female, or you can downstep it as positive, negative. Okay. But you know, it's a different expression of that twofoldness. You know, and the very fact that they, you know, they use those expressions, those words, aggressive. So in other words, the one who, you know, takes a step forward, the direction-like one, you know, and the one that draws back, you know, and follows that direction, you know, the retiring one. See, so it's, you know, the words are obvious parallels to direction, place. Okay. And so in a way, you know, that just, you know, you bring it, before you've made that recognition of male, female direction, place, that actually helps you to come around and say, oh, that's the deal with male, female direction, place. You know, so that was one of the things that, you know, was sort of coming together in the back of my mind years ago, you know, and finally, and then that's pretty obvious now that I think about it, that despite all of the spectrum that is a male and a female. The two bell curves are not on top of each other. They're definitely separated. You know, so no matter how much they overlap in the middle, the centers are definitely separated, and that's a very basic genetic unconscious manifestation that males and females do. That differential of direction in place. All right, let's see. Okay, now this bit about, remember the physics that we got into a little bit way back when we first started talking about angels? When we were talking about Sapernafim and Sakanafim and all those very high ones. They had that paragraph where they were talking about how these pairs can synchronize with the Father's circuits, the Son's circuits, the Spirit's circuits, and they were pointing out, when they need to work in pairs and when they can work individually, and they told us that the seraphim, and so here we are finally to them, that the seraphim, in order to lock on to any of those circuits of any of the three persons, any of the three infinite persons, they have to work in a pair. That neither of them, in and of themselves, has a significant enough spiritual polarity, quote unquote, they were calling it, to match up with these very high polarities that power those circuits. That for the seraphim, because they're clear down at this level, they need the greater polarity of bringing the two of them together, to get a high enough voltage, if you will. You want to just kind of think about it literally, to match up with that high voltage of even the lowest circuit of the infinite spirit, let alone the higher ones. Whereas the Sapernafim, they only needed to get that higher voltage by working in a pair to get all the way up to the top one, the Father's circuit. And they were hierarchical like that. Not because when you go to the Isle of Paradise, you don't somehow have the infinite spirit here and on a throne, and the eternal Son is on a higher throne, and the universal Father is, they're not hierarchical there in the center of the Isle of Paradise. Where are they hierarchical like that? As they engage out here, what's that hierarchical deity that they function in? The sevenfold, right? The universal Father in the sevenfold, the eternal Son in the sevenfold, the infinite spirit or the conjoint actor in the sevenfold, like on the psychic circles in the sevenfold. I mean, here, they're in a hierarchy. Father on top, Son, they're not all in the same plane of the upper surface of the aisle. So, we're talking about those three persons, their circuits, out here in the universe of universes. In other words, how they are not in some sort of direct expression from those three persons, but within the sevenfold. And they're these hierarchical circuits that they're trying to lock onto. And it takes, a high enough voltage, high enough polarity to do that. All right, now, there's a reason why I wanted to kind of rehash all of that, even though it's not demanded of you right here. But I wanted you to be thinking, getting into that more physics-like mode of thinking, okay? So that you wouldn't just blow past a word, okay? All right, so they say that in the majority of the assignments, it requires two angels to accomplish the task, and then it says, when they are not encircuited, okay, so we aren't trying to link up with those three circuits we were just talking about, they can work alone. Neither do they require complements of being when stationary. Okay. Now, what do they mean by stationary? Do they mean as long as they're frozen like this and you can't talk, don't blink your eyes? Okay, is that what they mean by stationary? That doesn't seem logical. Okay, so they don't mean frozen, in suspended animation. Do they mean as long as they're not traveling? It's like, well, let's think about that. Does that, so in other words, if one of them is going to walk across a room, you've got to have the pair in order to walk across the room? Well, that doesn't seem to match up. Besides that, I mean, an angel moving its arm like this, like I'm moving my arm, is just as much movement as walking across a room. So, no, that doesn't seem to make sense. I mean, that they actually have to work in pairs in order for one of them to move their arm. Yeah, you know, we're back to the whole thing suspended and animated. What do they mean? Do you have a thought?
Well, yes.
Okay.
And they're not ascending.
It's a thought. Okay, so, yeah, we've seen them use the word stationary, like the stationary sons of God, you know, or we were just using it relative to the permanent citizens, you know, that kind of or quasi-stationary nature, not ascending or descending. So you try to fit that. It's like, well, I don't know. I mean, because, you know, I mean, they're working on a horizontal level when they're syncing up with these circuits.
Yes. Wouldn't that stationary be like when they're at home? As a user, when they're at home, they're not working. When they're out, they would be working.
Right. I mean, there. It seems like it's something maybe like that. Right, you know, if you're not in the circuits, you know, it seems like maybe not ministering. Of course, you know, they just mentioned when they were home, you know, they're domiciled together. Okay, so I'm just kind of letting it play a little bit here. I want to, you know, notice if you really stop and try to reflect on what that word means. You know, it isn't immediately obvious. See, the more you kind of think about it, it's like, I don't know, maybe I... Yeah, you have a hard time convincing yourself. Okay, so let me tell you what's going on, okay? It's you have to be much more in the mode where you're thinking about things in terms of the physics of it, and not only the physics of it, the natural philosophy, the philosophical underpinnings of thinking about the literalness of things, you know, a physics. Okay? As I'm moving my hand like this in front of me, you might not say that my hand is stationary, but it is in the way that they're talking. By stationary, they mean it's localized. Okay? I mean, as I move my hand, okay, no matter where it is, it's localized at a point. I mean, my hand doesn't move because it delocalizes and is in every point in the room or something, right? It's at only one point at a given time, okay? The very fact that we currently think that it's a universe of matter, not a universe of motion, okay? We think that fundamentally material things are stationary facts, that then you can push and make them move, but they're not innately moving. Right? That's the current physics thinks of them as somehow stationary. Okay, yeah, and they aren't actually; they're in motion. But see, that's the kind of stationary we're talking about. You know, why do we think that, you know, it's a universe of matter? Because it appears to be a stationary phenomenon, to be localized at a point in space. You know, an electron, you know, or, well, let's don't go to electron because then you get into the fuzziness of quantum mechanics. But okay, so let's take an oxygen molecule in the room here. Okay? I mean, no one thinks that you know, if you zoomed in, that you wouldn't find that oxygen molecule at a particular point in this room. It's not somehow magically all over the room or something at the same time. It's localized. You know, you take a snap, if you take a photo of it, it's stationary. It's at a point, you know, where the shutter opened, right? It's stationary. It's localized. Okay? As long as, neither do they require competence of being wind stationary. The other time that they did this is when we talked about solitary messengers. And they talked about them, if they were stationary, they could work in a group. Think about that logically. If you weren't localized, could you work in a group? That would be hard to figure out. Right?
Technology.
Right. But we're not talking about you being in the cloud, yeah, and working with the group. We're talking about you being in the group. You know, the group is there, and you're in the group. You're localized. You're stationary. You know, and the group can move around the room, and everyone is still stationary, like we're thinking here. They're still localized. You know, if you're localized, you can have a relationship between those two localizations of that being. You know, think about how hard it is to have a relationship with a gravity messenger that's at infinite speed. Not very localized. It's everywhere, you know, instantly. Okay, yep.
Do they pray, angels? Because I'm thinking stationary to me would be more like solitarily praying or something.
Right, I mean, they're not going to be, they're not an evolutionary being like us, so they're not using that evolutionary ladder, that evolutionary technique of prayer to get them up to worship. You know, they can just be in worship, you know, just like we're all supposed to be. You know, again, remember, that's what we were stressing a lot last time, how they were trying to get us to really think about the parallel so that we start to think about where we should be trying to get to eye level with the angels, you know, rather than our animal origin starting point, you know. And that's a very poignant example of that. You know, they're not in, you know, they're not doing prayerful problem solving. They're doing worshipful problem solving, you know. And they do it in a very literal way, like they just mentioned here. They get themselves encircuited in the cosmos and solve a problem. Which is exactly what you're supposed to do. You know, you're supposed to be working, getting yourself up. I mean, that's what worship actually means. Remember, we're separating worship from adoration. Okay? Worship is not adoration. Worship is just synchronizing with the cosmos. Okay? And if you synchronize with that cosmos, like an angel synchronizes with the cosmos, you can solve problems. You can use the objectivity and the dynamic quality of the cosmos to solve problems.
Because you're not in the way.
Right. You know, you can't solve it because you're too low, you don't have the objectivity, and you're too static. So they're not praying, see? Again, you know, any more than they're male and female, like we were saying last time. You want to get yourself above being a male or a female. The extent to which you're still really locked down in being a male or a female, you can't worship. That's too far down. You've got to get above that. You've got to get up there where you're a person and not an animal origin creature, and persons aren't male or female. There aren't male and female personalities that come from the Father. You've got to transcend.
Never will the creature metamorphose so far as to...
Right. That whole issue about, you know, it doesn't change the fact that you're acquiring experiences, relate, you know, as a self. Okay, but I'm just trying to stress, you know, it's not, it's the higher self that is synchronizing with these higher facts, and the higher the self is, the less there is that differential. It doesn't mean that your lower self doesn't have that differential. Even when you're a finaliter, your lower self will still have a quality tied to the fact whether or not you started out as a male or female. Okay, but you will have aspects that go way transcendent of that within you as well. So that, you know, the higher you can get, the more equal, you know, two individuals can meet each other, right?
I think we're just male and female here just for the procreation.
Right, exactly, right. I mean, we're just, you know, but like Shane was just saying, I mean, when we have when we're Marantia beings, you know, we'll still be able to tell which one of us started out as a male, as a mortal, and which one of us started out as a female, as a mortal. But we won't be male and female anymore.
You'll always be Pam.
I mean, you have an experiential self, and that doesn't change, right? I mean, you're going to carry forward an experiential self from here, okay? But just remember, it's your distinguish between your experiential self and your personality, you know. And it's as that highest personality that you are synchronizing. I mean, think about just the angels here. Forget about males and females. Think about positive and negative. Can they synchronize with these circuits as a positive fact or a negative fact? No, they can't. They have to transcend that in order to synchronize with these circuits. A positive seraphim cannot even synchronize with the infinite spirit's circuits. A negative seraphim can't synchronize. They can't do it as their equivalent male-female differential. They have to transcend that. So they bring themselves together as a super additive consequence, and that which is a greater than positive and negative synchronizes with that circuit. You know, so think about that. I mean, you know, think about just, you know, while you're still mortals here. You know, if you can transcend in a relationship, you know, say husband and wife, male and female, get something that's super added, genuinely super additively transcendent, you'll synchronize with things that no male or no female can synchronize with. Right? You know, and so you have to be willing to, you know, allow that. You know, if you demand that what you are is the height of all things, okay, you are severely limiting your relationship to the cosmos. I mean, because the lowest levels are transcendent of male and female. The first imagined world is transcendent of it. I mean, so, you know, your relationship is not even of a quality that's equivalent to primitive humans being resurrected as Marantia beings on the first imagined world. What kind of a relationship is that? It's pretty limited, right? So, see, that's, you know, what you're trying to appreciate here. All right. Okay, so that whole bit about stationary, yep. Oh, did you have something, John?
Yeah, okay. So I was thinking, excuse me, you know, as you travel through your universe career with mm-hmm. your guardian angel,
mm-hmm.
so is that actually two beings?
Yeah, you've traveled with a pair.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it's two beings, but yet they always refer to it as the guardian angel, but it's actually two.
Yeah, not always. Every once in a while, they'll put in, you know, actually it's two, you know, but most of the time, for simplicity, they just say one. Now, why?
Which is, you know, to me, it sounds like going to be your best friend for eternity. Almost.
Oh yeah, right. I mean, they're going to be so close to you.
Friends,
yeah.
Right? Yeah,
exactly. Yeah, yeah, very close to you. You know, that brings a good point, though. I mean, talking about the positive, negative. I mean, again, they work in a pair, so technically, it's always a pair that you're ascending with. But there's one that's always the one that's stepping forward.
They're two different beings.
Right. You know, and so in a way, you know, you relate to them. Not as a pair side by side, but as a pair lined up like this. You know, and so there's a truth to calling it just one. You know, they're so perfectly synchronized, you know, that unless you go like this, you'd think there was one being. That's how together as one they are, you know, to the truth of what you're engaging. See, so in truth there's one, but in fact there's two. Like I said, every once in a while, you know, they'll remind you of the fact of it, that there's two. But most of the time, they're speaking to the truth of it, see? They're revealing the truth of your relationship. And then occasionally, they disclose the fact of it, that there's two.
So you think they have different characters? Yeah.
I mean, they have completely different personalities. Absolutely
so
unique
you
personalities.
You actually get to know both of them, but in certain ways as one, and in certain ways as maybe individuals.
Yeah, and so they not only have absolutely different personalities, but, you know, like we're pointing out here, they have different selves. I mean, you know, and that'll be the case until that bi-unification. You know, when they get up to Seraphington and, you know, and they actually go through that process where they become two beings that are actually at that super additive higher level. So then they're fundamentally individual beings, okay? you know, then their selves won't have this positive-negative differential. But until then, all the way up, they will have that, you know, at the same time that they have the absolute unique personality. You know, so that'll be interesting, you know, once you engage them in, after that by unification, you know, it probably will be all the more clear what's the personality contrast rather than what's the self contrast. And that's the same way with us. The more that we can get up, you know, where we can at least express at our highest level something that's transcendent of just ourself, the more I'll be able to experience you as the personality, the transcendent fact that you are, you know, and rather than that accumulation of self-experiential self. Yep.
I've been thinking a lot about this because I've been so, all this time, letting the body go, the new Maranch of me.
Uh-huh.
It just occurred to me so heavily that I'm going to wake up and I'm just going to always be me.
And at the same time, though, that you begin to really appreciate the distinction between yourself and your personality, don't swing all the way the other way and forget about yourself. Because technically, when you say you, you're not talking about your personality.
Right.
Talking about yourself. And that's very important. You're not just going to be some random new brain and body and everything with the same personality identified with it. You know, that Maranch structure, your soul, is a very precise, what would you want to call it, matrix of exactly, that exactly depicts your character as a self, not as a personality, but as a self. You know, it's a Maranch self. Not a bunch of personality. And so the fact that you will still feel like you're you in the next life is because that soul depicts you, and then on top of that's your personality.
Okay? That you is animal origin. Now, you get to keep it.
Right. Now think about the contrast with this. You know, we just mentioned the spirit-fused mortals. Okay? You know, it's a little bit different with them. I mean, they have the soul, okay? So they have their self, but it isn't immediately tied to the memories because, you know, the gesture doesn't come back for them. So there's that additional little bit. You know, thinking about a lot of what you think of as you is tied to your memories. So try to abstract that. Think about yourself. What's the difference between just myself and my memories? Can I imagine? Well, how would I experience myself if I didn't have my memories? Okay, so that's another little twist that's in there. So you know, see, we'll begin to appreciate this when we're resurrected. We'll be able to better distinguish between our memories, our actual just core self, our personality that identifies to that, and you see these various phases. Yep.
So, when you think about Jesus, you know, who had Michael's personality through a mystery of scenario.
Right.
And so when you think about, you know, you say to yourself, well, geez, you know, Jesus got all the way through the whole ascended life within 30 years, achieved everything,
yeah.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And you say, how do you possibly do that? Well, because the personality that entered that form, you know, was his personality. And that had so much experience, and so it was such a greater personality, it seems to me, than ours is today, or, you know, it's going to take a long time to get there. So he was able to contact things or be able to be aware of things that, because that personality had reached with such a magnanimous personality, which we probably, you know, we haven't gotten there yet, as you've said many times, in this very embryonic state of our personality.
Okay, well, you got to be a little bit careful of that, though, because other than the fact that Michael's a creator, but remember, technically, to get to the point of fusion, Remember, he didn't do that because there was a creator personality there. He was true man. You know, so, you know, through the mystery of mysteries of an incarnation, you have to think of that maturing Jesus, you know, as just having a creature personality. And there aren't higher and, you know, and lower creature personalities. They're all the same. Let's see. Well, see, what I'm trying to get, help to, again, separate the self from the personality. Okay, so you, I mean, there's nothing wanting in the gift that the Father gave me, my personality. The potential that it has, remember, personality is not teachable. It's existential. Okay, see, so it's complete and perfect from the get-go, but it's just a potential. Well, how does it actualize? Well, that's where the rub comes in. Okay, there are two reasons why Jesus could get it all done, you know, get to the point of fusion in such a short span of time. One, Gabriel very carefully picked some DNA, right? I mean, if Gabriel hadn't so specifically selected proper DNA, he wouldn't have done it in 30 years, okay? Right? So that was very important. And then the other key is he doesn't have to be a self-acting adjuster. It's a super, super, super experienced adjuster, okay? Self-acting, that specific is not relevant, you know? But the fact to get to a being self-acting, there's a vast amount of experience. It's a very, very experienced adjuster. And again, setting aside the experiences that it needs in order to handle also a creator and all that. But just, you know, the more experienced the adjuster, the less time it takes to get from point A to point B. So, you know, they adjust things much more efficiently, right, than a less experienced adjuster. So between those two things, very solid genetic starting point, and then a very positive environment to nurture that genetic starting point, and then this adjuster, you know, you maximize the speed, you know, of getting there.
Yeah. Had to grow to a certain point. You know, you can almost see the whole thing about up to 16 years old and all that kind of stuff. When he got to a point of where that personality could really begin to manifest itself, and then as it did, he became more and more aware of who he really was. He was able to, you know, access his father's gesture, came in communication. And they say gradually on an ongoing basis, and you know, his physical form, I agree with you.
But it's but it is really important to not think that he cheated.
It's not cheating.
Well, no,
just still had to live the life.
I know, but just appreciate what I'm saying. I mean, you don't want to diminish the true man part. He showed you what you can do. You know, given similar circumstances. We have a personality that can so consecrate us that we could achieve that.
Yeah.
Okay? Humans have fused in the mortal lifetime. Okay?
Yeah, I just think it was more than fusion for him.
Well, yes, beyond baptism. We're just thinking, you know, just up to baptism. So there's no true God in play. Right? I mean, you know, so like when he's on the Mediterranean tour, he's a third circler. Okay, he's just a third circler, and he's true man. Right, and so just, that's the only reason I just want to make sure that we, you know, there's always been a tendency for humans to want to say, yeah, but he was, you know, but he was God, and now we can say he was Michael. You know, you got to be careful about that thought. Don't bleed that into the pre-baptism life, or otherwise he cheated. If there was any God going on, then he didn't show us what we can do. He showed us what a God can do. And then it's of no relevance to us. Okay, if I can't study what he did around the Mediterranean tour and say, oh, that's relevant to me. I would have, well, it's not really relevant to any mortal, because that's only what only a God can interact with people like that. No,
I've done that before too.
I can do that.
Excuse not to do it.
Right. See, it's very, very important. Okay. If we don't do that, then they've wasted their time telling us about the pre-baptismal life. If you just bleed the public life and the Christian consciousness into the pre-baptismal life, you destroy the usefulness of that life story.
I thought he had memories. I thought he had visions before the baptism of his true identity and his memories of who he was.
It's only when he starts to have some definitive relationship with his adjuster, you know, the things can come in. Yeah, and you didn't have someone come up to you at your bar mitzvah, you know, and say, you know, it's time you were about your father's business. Okay, all right. I mean, yes, right. I mean,
well,
just be really careful to keep that very, you know, the parts so that you don't make it so that it has no relevance to you and think, I can't even think about doing that because that was Michael that did that.
And they say it's a mystery they don't even understand. Right. So it's hard for us to
see. And that's the mystery, that it doesn't bleed. The mystery of mysteries is that the God and the man aren't bleeding together, that whole time they're separate. I mean, he didn't have access to Michael until baptism. You know, he had things through the adjuster. Yes. Okay. But you know, you can, you know, think about if you're a first circler. What if your adjuster has been in 50 other beings? You know. Maybe 10 of which chose iniquity. And I mean, okay, I mean, there's all kinds of things that, you know, you might have access to there that are way beyond you. See, so it's no different for Jesus. And just that's what I'm saying. Just really stress that. Don't let your Christian context that you, even if you didn't grow up Christian, you've grown up in the Western world, and you know about how Christians think about it. I mean, and that's why when someone tries to fill in the blanks about Jesus' early life, they tell magical stories. Because they believe it was a God who was an 8-year-old. Well, those stories are worthless to you. Okay? Because you don't take mud and make it into birds and they come alive, like the magical Jesus was supposed to do when he was a little boy. Okay, those stories are useless to you. Okay.
I've read that somewhere. Where was that?
Those are just in some of those, you know, those stories that people made up, those extra biblical stories. Okay. You know, the very fact that you, in the New Testament, you don't have that early part of his life, I mean, people made up stories to fill in the blanks. Okay. All right. Let's see here. So where were we?
Last paragraph.
Yeah, let's see. I'm just okay. So, okay. So let me just think about what else is in this paragraph here. Okay. So we're talking about the two angels being paired up. You know, and we got off on this transcendent thing because we were talking about the transcendence that's inherent in thinking about this. But definitely I want, you know, go back and read that bit about the solitary messenger sometime, if you're curious. And notice when they mention the stationary thing with the solitary messenger. You know, see, they're talking about that solitary messenger being able to work in a group. Well, if he's not localized, he can't work in a group. See, and that's what that means by stationary. And so when we get into the next paper, this will come back around again. When I explained to you what they about how the speed and all those things, and they start to talk about that, you need to have this ability to think about the physics a little bit in order to understand that an angel is not just completely by nature localized; they're partly delocalized. Okay, and it's not just because we're a lowly creature that we're localized all the time. They tell you very high creatures are also made where they're just localized. Okay, so it doesn't have to do with material, spiritual. You can have a very high spirit being that is completely localized, but this much lower being this seraphim, is two-thirds not localized unless they've localized themselves. See, that's what I say. When stationary, see? I want to be stationary now. I don't want to be stationary now. See, there's an option in play here. Okay? I want to be localized now. I'm going to function in a delocalized fashion now. Well, that could bring in all kinds of interesting inputs into your nature, some worshipful problem-solving abilities. That's now, even though you, I mean, are very, you know, localized, that's fundamentally what you're talking about. To be genuinely worshiping is to plug yourself into the cosmos and have access to that which goes beyond, you know, what's between your ears, you know, or inside of the outline of your body, you know. It's to take advantage of some delocalized reality. Okay? You have that ability not because of what you are, but because of what you've been given by grace. Okay?
They could leave their matrix.
Encirclement in the Holy Spirit and a personality allows you to do that a little bit. Okay? So again, remember what we're trying, like we stressed so much last time. We're not just trying to memorize some facts about angels. We're trying to figure out why this is relevant to us. Why understanding some things about the physics of angels is relevant to you. All right. Okay, and then just the one last little thing before we read that final paragraph of section 4. Notice that they're not bound at the hip, quote unquote, you know, in this pairing. You know, they point out that it's, you know, often they stay together as the original pair, but I mean, if nothing else, you can imagine, well, what if one of the pairs joins a rebellion? Okay, that would break the pair up. You know, and a million other things, you know, less dramatic that might happen. Okay. So they could have that kind of independence, you know, and maybe it could actually go that far, where one of them would go over the edge to iniquity and the other one wouldn't.
That's hard to comprehend.
Okay, but yeah, but they are, you know. So they, you know, that's reminding you a little bit again that you know, as a male and a female, we do depend upon each other a lot, you know, to complement each other. But we're made so that, you know, we can function. You know, if one parent dies, the other parent can take up most of the slack. See, so they're reminding you that with the seraphim, you know, that they have that a little bit degree of ability to stand on their own. What was that?
They don't divorce.
Right, well, they're not married, right? Like we read last time.
So, you know, talking about one parent dying.
Right.
We
all know what you're saying.
Okay,
yep.
Stationary be analogous in any way to the abilities of the midwayers?
Yes. See, and that's, like I said, we can talk about that somewhere as we go forward. See, that whole bit about the difference between midwayers and similar beings that they say, you know, and seraphim and similar beings. Yeah, and this whole bit about stationary, not stationary, how that might relate to why you can see them and now you don't, and see those issues, those physics issues. That's what I'm saying. That's what this is related to. Okay, yeah. All right.
Besides designated homes, seraphim also have group, company, battalion, and unit headquarters. They foregather for reunions every millennium and are all present in accordance with the time of their creation. If a seraphim bears responsibilities which forbid absence from duty, she alternates attendance with her complement, being relieved by a seraphim of another birth date. Each seraphic partner is thereby present at least every other reunion.
Okay, so first of all, let's just, you know, get a little fact in again. When they say millennium here, whose millennium are they talking about? What?
Universe's millennium?
Yeah, the local universe's millennium, right? So it's 5,000 years, right? You just, you know, make sure that you can put yourself properly in the frame of the paragraph. You know, so you start with a factual basis. You know, it's like, which time system am I using here? Paradise Havana, you know, super universe, you know, right? It's local universe time, right? So every 5,000 years, they go to a reunion. And all the ones that were born on that in that particular cycle, on that particular date, go back, and except for the little qualification they're giving you, and you know where they may have to alternate between the pairs. But it does tell you, oh, they are, you know, the positive negative pair are born at the same time. See, that's between the lines there. Okay, so you know you're going to have to have them being birthed in a number that's divisible by 2. You know, that number was 41,472. Yeah, that's divisible by 2, right? All right. So they, you know, they're birthed in pairs. Then you know you can see besides designated homes. I mean, if it wasn't obvious to you, they're bringing up another issue that's kind of familiar-like here. They not only have real homes, but they have real reunions. So again, they're something that we can resonate with, that there's a nostalgic sort of aspect that goes on with them, you know, that they want to all get together for a reunion. Okay. So, you want to just sort of keep those little tidbits that they throw out in mind as you're studying angels. You know, we're about to go into army mode with them, okay? Right, and so you don't want to misinterpret that, you know? And suddenly think, well, you know, they seem to be talking about something that would never have a home or a reunion. There's some cold, hard soldier, you know, with, you know, finely honed steel blade, you know, and this sort of stuff, you know. It's like, no, they want you to make sure you have that, which seems like something that might carry a blanket around to wrap around you when you're needing a blanket. Someone who has a home and goes to reunions. So they are that. You know, they're very much what you would expect of a very warm, gentle, ministering being, you know, would have the sentiment to go to a reunion and a sentiment to want to go back home. Safi. Okay, so they're stressing that. Okay, and then you go into, and then they're put into, you know, uniforms and marched and right. Okay, so that the contrast, they're both of these things, sword and salve at the same time. Yep.
So what does it mean a little bit later then when they, so if one of them, if they're having a reunion and they both can't go because there's something, one of them goes and then they get replaced by somebody else? So they always have a compliment?
Right, I mean, you always have to have a pair, right? Because they always have to be.
Like that thing you were mentioning earlier about, you know, what happens if one of them rebel, but in this case, if one of them goes to a reunion, the other one's stuck a lot, right?
Right.
Which is more likely.
Right. Right. But again, see, for whatever reason.
For a period of time, because, you know.
Well, yeah, okay, yeah, just think about that.
To get there.
Right, right. So if they're here, you know, it's going to be a long journey to Salvington. You know, it's many years just in the journey, even at 3 times the speed of light, and the journey back, and you know, and it's probably not a 5-minute shindig, right? It's probably a pretty big to-do that goes on for a while, these reunions, right? So, yeah, you know, so right now, your guardian, you know, your pair of guardian angels, you know, one of them might be on, back at Salvington in a reunion, and you've got a sub. All right, let's get a little bit more here.
5, seraphic training. Seraphim spend their first millennium as non-commissioned observers on Salvington and its associated world schools. The second millennium is spent on the seraphic worlds of the Salvington circuit. Their central training school is now presided over by the first 100,000 Nebadon seraphim, and at their head is the original or firstborn angel of this local universe. The first created group of Nebadon seraphim were trained by a corps of 1,000 seraphim from Avalon. Subsequently, our angels have been taught by their own seniors. The Melchizedeks also have a large part in the education and training of all local universe angels, seraphim, cherubim, and sanabim.
Okay, they didn't waste any time starting to kind of transition us toward where we're headed. You know, you glance down and see non-commissioned observers, and you just have a hard time not saying non-commissioned officers in your head. Because the second word starts with O even. Right, so, all right, you know, that's intentional there to speak of it in those terms. You know, they're definitely going to be commissioned, just like the military is. Okay, so their first millennium, in other words, 5,000 of our years, they're just on Salvington, where they were born. You know, so for 5,000 years, they're just there. You know, going to school. And then for the next 5,000 years, they're on the seraphic set of seven worlds, you know, the satellite and the six sub-satellites. Again, getting more training. Okay, and then the thing they throw in there, you remember how we had this kind of mysterious mention that before they get going with the real definitive production of angels, there's some precursor ones. There were some that they called pattern angels, and they put it quote-unquote. And then there was ones that they called angelic archetypes. Okay, and here they mention there's also a firstborn angel. So in the midst of all that, there's literally a very first something or other, pattern or archetype angel. You know, they don't give you a lot, you know, they just give you these little hints like this. And one of them is here. See, so you go, the first 100,000 Nebadon seraphim. Okay, so I stop and think about that for a second. They told you at the beginning that they're created in unit formation, which is 41,472 at a time. Well, 100,000 is not evenly divisible by 41,472. What's with there being some 100,000? So there's a little mystery there. That, you know, you wonder if maybe if you think about it more, if you could figure out how do you end up with an exact 100,000 for, you know, some sort of initial group. You know, not to mention you see also a base 10 thing going on there with how many came from Avalon, you know, the neighboring local universe, to help out. You know, it's not the way they tell you, about to tell you that they're broken up into all these different groups. It's a base 10 thing, 1,000 of them. So there's a curious base 10 thing coming in there. Just note that. And it has to do with this early phase. So there's probably some clues there. Let's see. And then the last one, we were talking about this early on. So the Melchizedeks also have a large part in the education and training of all local universe angels, seraphim, cherubim, and sanabim. Well, except we know they didn't tell us something there, right? Again, you know, the almost undisclosed and, you know, basically unrevealed angels, the lower order of angels, are also there. But it's just like at the beginning of the paper, you know, no hint of that. It's just a period, as if that's all there is, seraphim, cherubim, and sanabim, period.
Are they part of the first
200,000? Right, well, I mean, you're just left to, I mean, you know, there's got to be pattern archetype angels related to them and all this sort of stuff. See, so, as I'm saying, I mean, there's a lot of mystery here. You know, how many of these 100,000 are related to seraphim? How many are related to cherubim, sanabim? How many are related to those that other order of angels? Yeah, I don't know. But anyway, it just really stands out that you've got these base 10 numbers here, and then no explanation of why. So, all right, let's see, I think that's, yeah, let's go ahead.
At the termination of this period of training on the seraphic worlds of Salvington, seraphim are mobilized in the conventional groups and units of the angelic organization and are assigned to some one of the constellations. They are not yet commissioned as ministering spirits, although they have well entered upon the pre-commissioned phases of angelic training.
Okay, so they're obviously doing a top-down training regimen. They did Salvington, then they did their worlds, now they've dropped down another notch to the constellation level. So they're slowly being brought from so heavenly-minded they're no earthly good down to something that's of some earthly good. And it takes a long, long process to train them in a downstepping fashion so that they actually can relate to us.
Especially us.
Plus they mentioned a pre-commission, which is like, they're like non-coms at this point.
Right, and again, I was gonna mention, notice how they're freely using this designation, commissioned, pre-commissioned, yeah. Right, because of the next section that's coming up, you know. Right, and they've got the groups and units. Right, so, you know, they're, for those who, you know, we mentioned this a lot last time, but, you know, you see how they're gently leading you up. They know that a lot of people that are reading this don't like to think of angels as being in an army. Okay? Their worldview, if they're going to have army-like ones, it's like, well, isn't that those archangel things, you know, that are always holding swords in the statues, okay? But don't make my buxom winging thing, you know, a boot soldier, okay? Now, how dare you? Okay, remember, we talked about this a lot last time. I mean, there's a challenge here, and you can see how they're sort of gradually leading up to it. I mean, you need to come to terms with it. That every single angel, no matter how much they might be ministering in a very gentle, loving mode to the littlest of children, is nonetheless, you know, is in a group, company, you know, etc. in a very, very rigid regimen.
They could call them a bunch.
And, you know, an army.
You don't think some of them might be buxom winging?
Now,
they're not going to all look alike. Some of them could be buxom
winged. Yeah, neither are there virgins in the next life, nor buxom winged things. Okay, I'm sorry to disappoint all the males on the planet. All right. Okay, so. All right, so we're going down. You know, you can just guess we're probably going to go down another notch.
Seraphim are initiated as ministering spirits by serving as observers on the lowest of the evolutionary worlds. After this experience, they return to the associate worlds of the headquarters of the assigned constellation to begin their advanced studies and more definitely to prepare for service in some particular local system. Following this general education, they are advanced to the service of some one of the local systems. On the architectural worlds associated with the capital of some Nebadon system, our seraphim complete their training and are commissioned as ministering spirits of time.
Okay, so yeah, definitely in general, they're, you know, they do the constellation stuff and then they do a local system training. They're slowly being brought down. But notice the last half of the process is quote unquote initiated by. So from the constellation level, they have them jump in the deep end. They plop them down on an evolutionary world.
Trenches.
Okay, and their hair is blown back by what they're experiencing. Wow, this is gritty real. This is nothing like my home back up there around Salvington. You know. Serious gritty stuff going on here. So they give them that little immersion. So they dip them in it a little while as long as they can hold their breath, and then they pull them back up to the constellation level and say, okay, so now let's do some more training here based upon what you just observed. You know, you notice they weren't allowed to touch anything. You know, they were just there to watch, you know, their mouths hanging open, right, for a little while. Try to take it all in, okay? So. Wow, that's nothing like what I saw in the textbooks. Okay, I mean it smelled and right.
Right.
Full smell-o-vision, you know, when they go, right? Okay. Think about it. I'm trying to play this up to if you appreciate, you know, don't think of this in some abstract terms. Think about it very literally. I mean, this is what they have to go through. It's all very educational to them. Okay. All right, so they finish at the constellation, then sure enough, they finally get assigned down to a local system because of a whole bunch of rigmarole there again. And now finally they're ready to be assigned. To be commissioned, okay, as ministering spirits of time. All right.
When once seraphim are commissioned, they may range all Nebadon, even Orvantan, on assignment. Their work in the universe is without bounds and limitations. They are closely associated with the material creatures of the worlds and are ever in the service of the lower orders of spiritual personalities, making contact between these beings of the spirit world and the mortals of the material realms.
Okay, so right at the beginning of that, remember what we went through a whole bunch last time, you know, and they were giving us that very top-down initiation of talking about them, so we knew that they had the potential to not be just stuck in the local universe they're born in, and here they're mentioning that. And they're obviously, you know, as they're just stressing before they go into the details, going to do a zillion different tasks. Yes, they are, the seraphim, in contrast to those other six types that are unrevealed, are most definitively tied to the ascension scheme, but it's not like that's all they do. Again, you know, even for seraphim, it's not all about you and, you know, watching you run around and making sure that you don't stub your toe and stuff like that. Okay, all right. So they have a lot of tasks. They're ever in the service of the lower orders of spirit personalities. And we all know, once you get into the details in the next paper about seraphim, you know, they're doing all kinds of things besides being guardian angels, right? So, yeah, all right. All right, let's get into the organization. So, just read that first paragraph, and they'll remind us where this happens in the story.
6, Seraphic Organization. After the second millennium of sojourn at Seraphic Headquarters, the seraphim are organized under chiefs into groups of 12, 12 pairs, 24 seraphim, and 12 such groups constitute a company, 144 pairs, 288 seraphim, which is commanded by a leader. 12 companies under a commander constitute a battalion, 1,728 pairs, or 3,456 seraphim, and 12 battalions under a director equal a seraphic unit, 20,736 pairs, or 41,472 individuals, while 12 units, subject to the command of a supervisor, constitute a legion numbering 248,832 pairs, or 497,664 individuals. Jesus alluded to such a group of angels that night in the Garden of Gethsemane when he said, I can even now ask my Father, and he will presently give me more than 12 legions of angels.
Okay, so that give us the first bit there first, and then a little anchor point to pin it to. So, but let's go through it. So know it, the one thing that you might forget, you know, everyone who's read the book remembers there's this paragraph where they give you all those numbers about how the angels are broken up. Don't forget the other element that's in there. There's a leader, you know, at each one of these levels of the hierarchy. Okay, so, you know, you don't just have, say, the 12 pairs in the group. You've got a chief. Okay, and you don't just have the 144 pairs in a company. You've got, that one's actually called a leader, etc. So, you know, you go, well, maybe when you're thinking about the 100,000 up there, maybe you got to keep things like that in mind. You know, you got to keep track of the additional ones like that.
So, anyway,
just, you know, that's pointing out to that, you know, there's some other structure here than, you know, is immediately sort of remembered. Okay, and then remember, so there we have it. Finally, the word unit is not a generic term; it's a specific term. Okay, and there's the 41,472, like they said up front. Okay, now put in the context. Okay, and all of this. Okay, you notice after the second millennium. You know, so remember back in our story up there. So once they do that second 5,000 years on their worlds, then they get put into these. All this hierarchy. So the whole bit when they're going through the constellation, local system, all that, they're already in all of this rigid structure. Okay? So, you know, then that invokes the question, it's like, well, you know, how does that work? I mean, are they sent to constellations in some units like this, or, you know, not literally units maybe, but companies or whatever? Okay, so all this complexity is in play with when all of that training is going on. All right, okay, and then, like I said, the anchor point. So here you literally have the passage pretty much, you know, straight out of the Bible, out of Matthew, about, you know, where it says in Matthew, I can even now ask my Father, and he will presently give me more than 12 legions of angels. Okay, now if you remember how that story is told, you know, up there in part 4, they say, well, okay, the way it's said there in the Bible, that's not quite precisely the fact. That was, you know, muddled a little bit. Okay, he has exactly 12 legions of angels that are assigned to him. The more than part, there's exactly 12 legions of angels, but then there's a bunch of the angels' associates. You know, like you could guess probably cherubim and Sanabim, if nothing else, okay, that's what gives it the more than part.
You don't think it says that he asked him to get more?
And I don't, because it literally says in the Jesus papers, you know, it explains that.
Yeah, but
okay.
Doesn't mean if he asked, he couldn't get more.
But see, it also doesn't say in the Jesus papers that he said it that way, that he could ask. See, that's the other thing. If you actually go and look exactly what he said, as opposed to what's in the Bible, you know, it's a little different. He isn't asking the Father, you know, up in the Jesus papers, and, you know, like I said, that's just literally what's in the Bible. Okay. See, so if you, I mean, well, obviously, but, you know, but again, the whole point is just to take that, you know, go look up the two places in the Jesus papers that talks about this. The one where he's actually in the garden, you know, and with the soldiers, and Peter's wanting to, you know, flash a sword around. Okay, so go find that passage. That one's easy to find. And then find the other one where it mentions the 12 legions. You know, okay, when they're actually assigned to him, and see what it says explicitly. What's going on there?
Okay. Can you take 12 times that 497,664? Is that how you get the amount?
Right. I mean, again. I mean, all of these are just, you know, you just multiply them out, you know. If you have 12 pairs in a group, you know, and there's 12 groups in a company, 12 times 12 is 144, you know, et cetera. It just, you know, yeah, you're just multiplying by 12 and get all those numbers. You know, if you take 3,000...
Legions is 35,801,808 pairs.
Right,
well, there.
Right, we're gonna get there next. Yeah. Right. Okay. It's just you're just they're just so you don't have to multiply it out there. You know, it's all written there.
And the angels don't have to, they just look at them and know.
Right, there's always that. Okay. All right, so let's get the rest of the story here.
I mean, that's a lot of angels.
Exactly. Maybe I could just mention that before we read some more. If you read that in the Bible about 12 legions, any sort of human interpretation of that is going to be a gross underestimate, because you're going, well, okay, this was written back in Roman times, I guess it's referring to Roman legions. Well, a Roman legion was at best, say 6,000 men. No, we're talking a little bit more than 6,000 angels. We're talking about a lot more than 10,000 angels. Right? Right, and we're about to read exactly what we're talking about. Okay.
12 legions of angels comprise a host numbering 2,985,984 pairs, or 5,971,968 individuals, and 12 such hosts, 35,831,808 pairs, or 71,663,616 individuals, make up the largest operating organization of seraphim, an angelic army. A seraphic host is commanded by an archangel or by some other personality of coordinate status, while the angelic armies are directed by the brilliant evening stars or by other immediate lieutenants of Gabriel. And Gabriel is the supreme commander of the armies of heaven, the chief executive of the sovereign of Lebanon, the Lord God of hosts.
Okay, so they're bringing it all the way home. So in other words, he was assigned a host. I mean, he wasn't technically assigned 12 legions. He was assigned a host. But if, Jesus says 12 legions, and for them, a legion was a big enough number, they got the point. The handful of soldiers that were in front of them, was going to be overwhelmed by 12 legions, even if a legion only means 6,000 to you, or even if it's just 3,000, right? So Jesus got his point across by, instead of saying a host, by saying 12 legions. Yeah, but technically, he was assigned exactly one host. And then you're reminded, and a seraphic host is commanded by an archangel or, some coordinate. Oh, well, that kind of makes the whole archangel statue with the sword thing a little more true, doesn't it? Okay. Even though Gabriel is not an archangel, Michael's not an archangel, etc., the idea that you would have, this leader, technically, what's it called here? What is it there? Can you find it?
Over what division?
Yeah, over a host.
Oh. An archangel.
Oh, yeah, right. See, it doesn't say, you had chiefs, let's see, and then we had leaders, and then we had, we had directors, and then we had a supervisor, okay.
There's a commander.
Yeah, see, where's the commander?
The 12
companies. Yeah, okay. Right? Okay, but you get up to here, you have a host, and you lose those names. You notice that?
Yeah.
Okay. So, and then if it's not, and then they explicitly say, that it's not a seraphim that's called a chief or a leader or something like that. See, it's a different type of being. Oh, so now you see why he broke it up into two paragraphs. Okay. When it gets up to the level of a host, it's kind of in a whole other domain where in order to coordinate such a vast number, it takes something that's more than a seraphim to be behind it, okay? and just notice that a little bit. And sure enough, when they said directed by brilliant evening stars or by other immediate lieutenants of Gabriel, there they are again, those unrevealed others that are his lieutenants. They never miss an opportunity to remind us of them. Okay, and then the other thing that they're obviously doing there is saying, you know, those passages in the Bible, be it the Old Testament or the New Testament, that speak in militaristic ways about celestial beings. That isn't because very militaristic humans wrote that only. They're trying to point out there's a very definite truth there. There is literally angel armies. Okay. Okay, and let's take the last one first. Lord, the Lord God of hosts. So that is used in the Old Testament, and sometimes, you know, in a more modern translation, they won't even say it that way anymore. They'll say it in some other way, so it doesn't sound so militaristic. You know, but you see, the revelators here are saying, no, think of Michael of Nebadon as the Lord God of hosts, where a host is 12 legions of angels, you know. So they're wanting you to put Michael into this too. If he needs to be, the guy in charge of all this, you know, he can be. All right. Okay, and then the supreme commander of the armies of heaven, you notice that you got basically Gabriel or his lieutenants there. Okay, now the armies of heaven. Okay, that's Revelation. That's in the book of Revelation. Okay, and the supreme commander, and okay, this doesn't literally say supreme commander there in Revelation, but it talks about this magnificent individual that's leading the armies of heaven who's on a white horse and, right? Okay, what passage is that? You know, that's mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord. He is trampling out the vintage where the grapes of wrath are stored. He has loosed the faithful lightning of his terrible Swiss sword. Right, the truth is marching on. That's where that passage from the battle hymn comes from, right there. See, so they're reminding you that most definitive line, you know, passage, I should say, in the Bible. You know, trampling out the vintage where the grapes of wrath are stored. That's what they're invoking here. Okay, so when Michael is saying, I could call them down. Okay, they're not going to come and negotiate. Okay?
No mediation.
All right? That's what's between the lines here. They literally invoked that point towards the end of the book of Revelation where, okay, the army comes in and people going to die. Okay? So it's you want to appreciate the strength of that reference there.
When he says that about he could call him Father, and but he is the Lord God of hosts, so he wouldn't have to ask anybody.
Yeah, and now... Right, now that he's sovereign, see, that's definitively true, right? See, yeah. Well, now that he's sovereign, you know, Lord God of hosts doesn't refer to the Universal Father anymore. You know, and he's just vicegerent to the Universal Father. Now he's sovereign. He's the Lord God of hosts. And if he wants to send an angelic army to point, B, right. It's an army, and it goes there, And so again, see, between the lines, you're invoking Revelation. You're invoking that whole thing. When they talk about angels up in paper 114, they mention the angels of the trumpets out of Revelation. Again, try to remind you that if angels need to be an army, they can be an army. And it's like, well, yeah, but I thought they couldn't interact with material things and whatnot. Well, they have associates too, right? Okay, so they're just invoking that there could be a literalness that you initially don't think that you think that the Bible is off in anthropomorphism land. you see, in the, those passages. And they're trying to remind you, yes, but not totally. Okay? The angels of nation life are the angels of the trumpets. Not they're like them. Okay? And so if something, if the Lord God of hosts wanted something to happen like is described in Revelation, he could order it. All the machinery is there to do it. Okay? Doesn't mean he's going to, but they want to remind you that, you know, that humans don't have the last say in things, you know, even to the nth degree. All right.
But just sort of, it's interesting to note that, in fact, he didn't. And probably, you know, when you get to know, probably never would have.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, you know, he sacrificed himself, so to speak. Or he allowed, rather than retaliate or use what he could have,
right.
He,
right, exactly. Right.
The exact thing that we need to learn how to do in a way.
Our Michael didn't do that. But is he the only Michael in the universe of universes?
Mm-hmm. No. See, but and so. You have to believe that he represents, you know, a sort of a side or a mercy side.
Yeah, right. No, remember, he's mercy dominated.
Take the Father's.
There's other Michael sons that are not like that.
Right.
Who probably use the army aggressively.
I mean, you can get that out of Revelation.
Well, no, see, but that's what I'm trying to get at. Again, it's related to what we were just saying about the six angels at the beginning. Notice that we're in the same discussion mode. We're trying to challenge that the universe doesn't have to be warm and fuzzy. I mean, obviously, it's God's wish, but it would be. I mean, like you say, you know, it is the Father's wish, the universal Father's wish, that all of us would reach the aisle. But all of us don't. Some of us rebel. Okay? And there's executioners. And see, the part of the, you know, you don't want to gloss over this part of the revelation, the part that's trying to challenge a very mushy worldview.
But you talked a while back about the mother and how she reacted to the rebellion,
mm-hmm.
You know, and which was basically said, you know, oh, go out and join it if you want to. So it's, in other words, open the door. As opposed to doing what you're saying. So you're saying that, are all mothers different also?
No. I mean, there's a lot of similarity. Okay, but they're all, you know, unique personalities. But remember, that mother is acting in the wake of a rebellion. Right? So, I mean, it's just, you know, the point of that is just, you know, it's not just the Lord God of hosts that might do something definitive if it needs to be done. Mom, you know, might do something definitive too.
The way it was in my day.
Okay. Yep.
You know, in several places, when you see the word supreme,
mm-hmm.
So it's like a human army, the ordinary rules don't apply, and the ordinary concerns, the things that might ordinarily concern people, when there's a war to be fought, set aside, and there's a supreme objective that takes precedence over everything.
Mm-hmm.
Everything else becomes secondary.
Yeah.
And that's what it's, I'm hearing the same thing here.
Right, right. I'm trying to get you to allow for that. I'm not saying that this is the norm, and then the revelers aren't saying this is the norm.
But
if you don't allow it at all, it's like, well, no, the universe could never be prickly. Then you're missing, you know, something the revelators are trying to teach us. Okay? You know it's going to be a very rare event that there's some sweeping prickliness. Okay? Because I mean, if they had to do massive exterminations every other day, that would mean there's no wisdom in the universe. Okay, you know there's endless wisdom in the universe. Okay? But there's also absolute free will. And absolute free will can trump supremacy. Doesn't matter how supremely wise things are, there's still absolute free will that can reject that wisdom. Okay? And so they're just trying to remind you that don't take everything in the Bible literally, but occasionally when they invoke it, they're saying, now remember that passage? Don't totally dismiss that. There's a truth there. The Most High's rule in the kingdoms of men, for instance.
And could it be that a couple hundred years of the world aren't battle armies, but armies that are out there doing good. And, you know, they look back on it and say, oh, those old armies in the old days, you know.
Well,
and I'm just wondering.
So well, I mean,
these armies are actually, I would imagine, they're armies that go out and do good more than they do.
Well, that's the thing that we're left, you know, notice they don't explain that. What, I mean, you've got all of these angels, you know, including, say, Salonia, the voice in the garden. She's in an organization like this. Okay? Okay, so, you know, to try to understand, like, well, you know, why invoke the military thing?
That's what I was just trying to say.
Right.
Because maybe in a few hundred years, that military thing will mean something different.
Don't worry about it, John.
Well, okay, here, I got a question here, too.
Well, it's just a rugged reminder the flip side of love is law.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
God's law.
Right. You've got it. See, that's the thing that is so often forgotten.
Yeah.
You know, when you're saying that Michael is now the Lord God of hosts instead of the Universal Father, you know, okay, the Universal Father, there is no difference between the word law and the word love. They're the exact same word. Okay? So when Michael loves, there's just as much law as there is what you initially think of when you hear the word love, especially now that he's sovereign. You know, he's not top dog, he's sovereign. Okay? You know, they chose that word for a reason. You know, and all of the law that implies, okay, and all of the law that armies imply, and all of this structure, okay, it's trying to get us to think, you know, in the terms of the biggest problem we have on this planet because of the Lucifer Rebellion. We don't know the difference between true and false liberty. Okay. You don't have the liberty to be loved without law.
It's a price to pay.
Right? The only kind of love that you're going to get is the kind that's law love.
Okay? And remember what Emmanuel told Michael when Michael was about to leave.
Oh, yeah.
Right. I mean, why is the Battle Hymn of the Republic, you know, one of our hymns? It's the same reason why we say liberty in law. Thy liberty in law. Another one of our hymns. Right? I mean, this country is founded upon a basic recognition of what's being revealed to you here. Okay? That if you want to synchronize with the universe, you have to have law and love together as one. And any idea that you can separate the two, that's the rebellion. That's what Lucifer wanted to do. Lucifer wanted to love without law. He didn't want to hate, kill, darkness, orgy, darkness, and death. And that's not what he wanted. He wanted to love without law. He wanted to manifest false love. And every human on the planet that wants to do the same thing is effectively part of the rebellion. They want to love without law. Okay? That's false love. And if we continue to do it, it won't just be an emergency that'll give us a revelation. As they tell you in paper 118, you'll have the collapse of civilization and the Dark Ages. If you continue to falsely love like you're doing, if you continue to think that the words legal and loyal are not the same word. You know, they're literally the same Latin word, legal and loyal. It's two sides of the same fact. Law and love are the same thing. Okay? This is the crux of the whole issue. See, and so you take the lovey-doveyest beings that humans have ever thought of, buxom winged things, okay, or cherubs, right? and you put them into this rigid military structure, okay? That's what they're trying to get you to appreciate. That this is, you know, this revelation, this is directly revealed to the most problematic aspect of the Lucifer Rebellion on the planet today, like they say, the beginning of the True and False Liberty section. Okay. Was it you that just, or you, yeah.
So if you're going to have that many pairs or individuals running around, in order to not have utter chaos, you would have to have some major forms to how things are done and, you know, what's done and all that.
Right. Think, you know, at the beginning of this paper, they were challenging you to strike step with the angels. Go up and strike step with the angels. Look what they're asking you to strike step with. Like Katie is just saying, the obvious. There has to be such an incredibly intense logistic organization going on here. You know, a rigid structure, or it'd be just a complete chaos. I mean, look at how big these numbers are. Toss a whole handful of hosts onto a planet without any rigid structure, and you'd have just complete chaos. You know, especially because they're not very self-directing beings, Seraphim. They're really dependent upon being directed. You know, if they lose their direction, they go into rebellion and hordes, right? Lemmings over the cliff. All right, so, see, they're telling you to go up into true love, which is also law, okay? And see your liberty, your true liberty in law. Okay, and don't be afraid of mine eyes have seen the glory. Okay, it's not mine eyes have seen the horror of the angelic army. Mine eyes have seen the glory.
I don't think they're trying to scare us to death.
No, there's a beauty.
Yes.
In the structure.
That's what I was going to say.
Yeah.
Who doesn't get tears in their eyes when they see 1,000 men marching in review?
I don't.
There's something very viscerally emotional about.
I think it's scared out there marching.
No, no. I mean, your point is valid. You know, Maria. Yes.
Thank
I mean, no. I mean, and that's the whole point. Okay. Can you feel the same way about angels as you used to? Can you have the angel that has reunions and a home with a nice comfy, you know, chair and a, you know, and a footstool, pretty paintings on the walls.
When is you bring your slippers?
Right. Okay. Can you have that and, you know, legions?
Okay.
Can you put the two together? Can you put law and love together? Okay. Until we do, it's not going to get better on this planet. It's going to get worse.
Can you imagine the music that they're marching to?
Yeah. Okay.
That would get you.
If we had liberty and law together, we wouldn't have this book. Right. Okay.
Though serving under the direct supervision of the Infinite Spirit as personalized on Salvington, since the bestowal of Michael on Urantia, Seraphim and all other local universe orders have become subject to the sovereignty of the Master Son. Even when Michael was born of the flesh on Urantia, there issued the super universe broadcast to all Nebadon, which proclaimed, "And let all the angels worship him." All ranks of angels are subject to his sovereignty. They are part of that group which has been denominated his mighty angels.
His mighty angels. Okay, so just see, to wrap it up, they mine the Bible a little bit more. Okay, you know that the Super Universe broadcast didn't quote the book of Hebrews. Okay, you know, so it's another great example of, okay, literally in the book of Hebrews it says, and let all the angels worship him. What the actual broadcast said, who knows? But in truth it said that. Okay, so you say, oh, we can use that line. Yeah, and then we can also use that line, you know, in another one of the epistles, his mighty angels. Okay, and what's the context there? Again, it's the Lord God of hosts commanding his mighty angels to bring time to an end, you know? Let's do that fine thing.
When they have those icons of the angels, like the one slaying the dragon, there's one of some kind of wishy-washy little angel.
Right. See, so again, you know, that's what they're trying to do by bringing in passages in the Bible like that, and then bring in all the other things that are outside of the Bible. They're trying to help you to appreciate there's a truth to the to that sword-like angel idea that humans have had. Okay, they're not going to literally, you know, do it anthropomorphically like humans have thought. Okay, but in some way, it is literally true that they're his mighty angels. They're not his warm, fuzzy angels. They're his mighty angels. They can be warm and fuzzy too, but they can also be mighty. Okay? See, they're not male and female. Even though we call them she, like we were talking about last time. You know, they explained why they were using that female pronoun. Okay? They're not technically she as in female she. Okay? They're daughters of the mother. And that's why they're calling them she's. Okay. But so they can either play that more father-like mode or the more mother-like mode, depending upon the circumstances. The angels of nascent life don't sit there blowing the trumpets day in and day out. Once in a blue moon, though, they blow the trumpets. Right?
Law can be enforced.
So they can be like mama bears.
Right. Yeah. That God will not be mocked. Okay, there's lines. Okay, you know, and see, there's an edge here. I mean, they're trying. You know, they're not trying to scare us straight, but they are trying to tell you that you know you can cross lines where things could be fixed in ways that are, you know, a little starker. Okay, it's your choice. They're saying, no one wants to do that. Okay, and no one will probably have to do that because most likely you'll just you know go into a dark ages and what are the two things that get your head straight again? Fear and hunger, right? They don't need to blow the trumpets. Fear and hunger are plenty adequate to get all these false love ideas out of your head. Okay, but they're saying, I mean, but you know, you might get really willful about this. You are actually finally beginning to be philosophic enough that you can consciously join the Lucifer Rebellion instead of just being unwittingly following along in his footsteps, okay? And if you really go that far, if you start to will yourself like that, okay, then fear and hunger are not going to be enough. Any more than fear and hunger is going to fix the Lucifer problem, you know? You know, you send the executioner eventually. Okay, you don't just wait for him to starve to death. So you know, they're just reminding you that that's in play. Just appreciate that. God is boss, you know, and he will draw lines at some point, you know, and he's able to draw big lines. You know, he doesn't just have a handful of secondary midwares, you know, to do this sort of job if it needs to be done. He's got numbers that are hard to keep straight when you're reading them, they're so big, you know? Just to read one army, it's like, well, how many armies does he have? Right? I'm sure it'd be pretty hard to count the number of seraphim in the universe of universes. Right? Okay, so, all right, we better wrap it up there, but that's, you know, you see, next time we'll transition into cherubim and seraphim, and you're going, oh, wait a minute, that seems like a really harsh place to leave the seraphim, you know, listing their army things and ending with his mighty angels, period. Well, you know, we'll get back to them in the next paper and it won't be so stark. But they put this up front, notice that. They want you, you know, when you go and start thinking about Solonia as a voice in the garden and all these sorts of things and whatnot, you know, it's all in the wake of this, okay? That angels can mean business if they need to mean business, okay? And there's some truth to you talking about a flashing sword, you know, keeping Adam and Eve from coming back into the garden, you know, quote unquote, even though it's all anthropomorphic. Right? There's some literalness to that. You know, they say, no, It doesn't matter if you don't want to. The answer is no. All right, let's take a moment to reflect on that.